2021 marks the 400th anniversary of the first Thanksgiving as practiced by the Pilgrims in Plymouth, Massachusetts. We're going to talk about this right now and who exactly were the Pilgrims. Our guest is a Pilgrim expert. He is so knowledgeable about this subject. He is the president of Plymouth Rock Foundation. His name is Dr. Paul Jaley. And this is Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb. And Paul Jaley, it's great to have you back on the program. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, very good to be with you.
I think a good way to set the whole scenario here is to back up before we get into Thanksgiving itself and talk about who exactly were the Pilgrims. I think there's some misunderstandings about them in our day.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, when people talk about the Pilgrims, they may not recognize that they were a small group, a remnant, of a church plant coming out of Leiden, Holland. And that small group of about 75 people produced, they were probably the two-thirds of the whole group on the Mayflower ship that sailed in 1620. And they're a lot overshadowed by the Puritans in 1630 when they come here with a massive migration in the thousands. So this small pilgrim band would be looked at as persecuted believers who wanted to be true to the Word of God, whatever it should cost them, they wrote. They're the ones that came here to Plymouth and established the Plymouth colony and also successfully, to a large degree, built relationship with the local natives and, in essence, began to practice the application of their faith and biblical truth to the commonwealth that they produced, this small Plymouth plantation, as it was initially called, and set the foundation stones for later revivals and restoration throughout America.
You know, you once made a very interesting observation to me. I've never heard it from anybody else, and I think this is a fantastic point. It's sometimes in this world, people can choose for power and the love of power, and we see this a lot in among many politicians and so forth. But you said on the other side, there are those who go for influence, who want to do, you know, influence things, especially for God's glory and others' good. And the Pilgrims were not powerful people in this world, but they definitely were influencers. Can you elaborate on that? I love that point.
Sure. I think that the critical aspect about that is that when you want to live your life for the glory of God and you're not looking for fame and you're not looking for fortune, your number one goal is not to conquer. It's not to get wealthy, even though you certainly would love to live in some kind of sustaining way. Then you're coming for your character to be an influence. And that's the way the Pilgrims were. It was their character that influenced future generations as well as their own generation. And I think that that is often missing because really the deficit in America today is not wealth, it's not power, it's not glory, it's not fame. We have all the people that want to be famous and they want to worship themselves and they want everybody else to worship them. What we have a deficit in is character and virtue. What the founders of our nation talked about, and of course what the Pilgrims came here to live out. They were concerned that people would live according to their profession. That was their goal. Of course they didn't do it perfectly. No people can. But it's that idea that influence is much better than power. And this was a contrasting movement. This was a remnant. It was a footnote in history. People didn't even think about those people that left on that Mayflower. What could they do? It's only a small group. They got even smaller by the time they get over here when the Speedwell sprang a leak and they had to sell the only ship they owned. Everything seemed to go wrong. People died, and yet they had said and committed to each other, this small group of Christians, look, we'll do it whatsoever it should cost us. And, of course, Bradford makes this statement that they came here to propagate and advance the gospel of the kingdom of Christ into the remote parts of the world, yea, though they would be stepping stones unto others for the performing of so great a work. So Bradford also illustrates the fact they didn't come here for themselves. They came here for future generations. And think of it, half of them died the first winter. Now there's only 51 left. More children were alive by ratio and proportion than adults. And they said, okay, we are stepping stones unto others. That's selfless. That's unusual.
And the Bradford you refer to is Governor William Bradford, their longtime governor, elected year after year. It was an annual post. And he also wrote about all this in Of Plymouth Plantation. Can you go ahead And just back up on one point, too, and that is, it's my understanding, they were not even sailing for Plymouth, Massachusetts. They were not even sailing for Massachusetts. Where were they heading, and what happened?
Well, they were heading for where their patent was, for Northern Virginia. And people can mistake that, because Virginia was everything on the East Coast up and to where we would see New England today. And they were coming there because most of the companies that were trying to finance explorations had gone out of business. And so when they came to sail, they were going to go where Manhattan is today. But they couldn't, because when they landed 2 months late due to the delay in their contract and all kinds of things that went wrong, they recognized that they tried to sail south toward Manhattan, but they hit dangerous shoals. The captain of the ship said, look, I'm going to have to just plant you here because I don't want to ruin the ship and lose everything. And, of course, they anchored inside what is now Provincetown Harbor. They ended up exploring and ended up in Plymouth. So they were blown off course. They came to the wrong spot. They didn't even have a patent for that. They had to apply for it. And, of course, because they didn't, and there was some talk of mutiny, they wrote up the Mayflower Compact. They wrote up their own laws without permission of the king. That was unheard of. And yet it was an extension of how they were taught by their pastor. They could govern themselves. We are so accustomed today to think that you have to have permission from government to do everything. And yet back then, they made that bold step at a time when it would have cost them more than it often costs us today. And they did that. Of course, they were separated by an ocean. And yet there they did, said, in the name of God, amen, we whose names are underwritten, the subjects of the king. So there was that power flow from God to them and out to government. Boy, that set a whole pattern of thinking. And uniquely in history, the Pilgrim Plantation there in Plymouth here was not a franchise. You did not have to be a member of the church to vote in civil affairs. And that was way ahead of the time, because that was distinct from the Puritans. So we have here a light that came to the coast that would look forward to a lot of the liberties we have today, even though they wouldn't have been understood at that time the way we do today.
And the Mayflower Compact, 1620, was really the first step, many historians say, towards ultimately the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution about 150 years later. Okay, comment on the Pilgrims and the Native Americans.
You know, the interesting thing is that you had two different distinct philosophies of discovery at the time the Pilgrims sailed. The negative one, which often gets a lot of the press, was the fact that in that papal bull of 1452, you could subjugate the natives, steal their land, disrespect them, and then preach to them. Well, the Pilgrims didn't come with that mentality. They came to serve. So they wanted to have peace with the local natives. And that's all they attempted to do the first few weeks and months. They made some mistakes in their exploration and even admitted it, that digging up a native grave. They were so interested to know who they were coming to who lived in this area. But eventually, by March of 1621, only a few months later, they were able to have peace with the natives. Now, here's the interesting thing about it. God's providence was working because that peace was initiated by the natives, not even by the English. They were trying to meet with them, but you know, the natives had been mistreated even 6 years before by the English, so they know they're not interested in anything except defending themselves. And here they come out of the woods, Samoset, speaking English. He gets Squanto, who comes later on, just a few weeks later, and here they're able to procure this peace with Massasoit. And that lasted more than 50 years, five decades. That is an amazing story, and it's that peace in March of 1621, as well as the reconciliation with the Nauset tribe that fired among them when they first came in August of 1621, which is the 400th anniversary this month, that paved the way for Thanksgiving. There would have been no Thanksgiving if there hadn't been peace between the natives, cemented by this Nauset reconciliation. What I mean by that, they apologized for the conduct of that Hunt, Thomas Hunt, years before, that harmed the natives and took them away as slaves. So we have, this is unheard of, that one race apologizes for what their race had done. And that paved the way for Thanksgiving.
Okay, tell us about the first Thanksgiving, 1621.
So in 1621, there was a tradition already in England about a harvest festival. And they would thank God for the harvest that they would bring in. Some believe it goes all the way back to the Feast of Tabernacles, usually in October as well. And the pilgrims were very astute at following the Jewish calendar and following a lot of the Old Testament roots of Christianity. But we're not certain about those things historically, but we think that there could be patterns there. But here, we don't know who invited whom. We're unaware of it. We just know what the account says. And that is that the pilgrims celebrated for 3 days with their local neighbors, the Wampanoag, who brought 90 with them. So the Native Americans outnumbered the pilgrims by at least 2-1. And here they had that first Thanksgiving, or that first harvest festival, as it was called, for all of those things. They had recreations. They had bow and arrow contests, evidently, maybe foot races, who knows, shooting contests. But here was a friendly 3-day recreation, thanking God for the harvest, which the native would have done as well, and a recreation in a peaceful atmosphere. This is unheard of. This is what makes this kind of a Thanksgiving unique. Not that the pilgrims had the first Thanksgiving on the continent or the first people ever to thank God for a harvest. That, of course, is not true. But what they did have was a peaceful relationship where there had already been a peace treaty or at least an alliance that had already been established. That makes this unusual.
It's strange, though, too, because I understand that every year now, just for, you know, for the last decade or so, there are Indian protesters, Native Americans who protest Plymouth as if the pilgrims, you know, started the bad things that happened to the Native Americans later on down the line.
Yes, and the thing, this happens all the time in American history where you get the wrong context maybe for a lot of this problem. Obviously, there were problems between the two cultures, but really, the issue of the day of mourning and all those things started 50 years ago now, back in 1970, and the problems were on both sides, and there were some issues there that, and people accentuate them. But think about it this way. Today, people take every little thing that they disagree with, it gets exaggerated into the most important things. Wouldn't you want to say, listen, in spite of all the differences and even the tension and the clashes, there were 5 decades of peace. That's probably the longest peace treaty with the Native Americans in our history. Let's emphasize the good and hand that good down to our children rather than just emphasizing the bad. You can always find something that's wrong. Let's point out the things that are the best that our children and grandchildren might have hope. And I like to portray it that way. Not that the pilgrims were perfect, not that the alliance was perfect. And both sides did some things to hurt the others. You're going to have that in any culture or any relationship. But let's emphasize the best and not just deal with that. And you have people who want to hijack that and they want to just, and it's not also, not always Native Americans that protest. It's other people who just, they just like to be upset at something.
Okay, we have about 1 minute left. The pilgrims actually experimented with socialism. It was kind of foisted upon them by the agreement that they had, you know, signed up to. But how did that work out?
Yeah, the pilgrims, with their contract that had changed at the last moment, ended up having to work for the common good, as it was called. And that way, people did not own their own land and did not have the complete freedom of their produce. And because of that, they nearly starved those first 2 years. When they went to more private ownership and more private productivity, they never had another day of starving. In fact, they tripled their crops for the next 2 years. So again, the pilgrims learned something we can learn from today.
Okay, 30 seconds concluding thought. And by the way, your website is plymrock.org, plymrock.org. Concluding thought.
Yeah, you can go to our website, plymrock, plymrock.org, and get all kinds of materials and books and others that you can learn more about the pilgrim story. And the book that I just published last year for the 400th anniversary, Journey of Faith, will show you how they applied the Bible to every area of life.
Paul Jaley, thanks so much for being with us. All the best.
All right. God bless you, brother.